And we're very lucky to be joined by our next guests, all the way down there in Taswija. It's Luke Whittle. Good morning to you, Luke.
Good morning, Richo. Pleasure to be here.
How you doing? We're also joined by the Doc, Ewan Proctor, who's in the Yarra Valley.
Good
morning, Ewan.
Now, Luke Whittle, you're the winemaker, chief winemaker there at Piper's Brook and Craiglinger, amongst other things, but I'm detecting a wee bit of an accent. Where are you from? Where are you from originally, buddy?
Very astute. Yeah, you've got there, Richo. I am originally from New Zealand, so a little town called Whangamata, which no one would have heard of. It's okay. It's a little beach town of the Coromandel Peninsula in the North Island there.
Yeah, right, eh? Is it close to any wine-growing regions?
No, we're not. We're probably, closest would be West Auckland, Waiheke, to us for the main region. So we're about 2 hours out of Auckland, just sort of heading southeast down on the east coast there.
Okay.
There was one vineyard went in on one beach north from us who did some wine, and I believe still have a label up there, Ohui. But in the most part, there's not a lot of wine going down around Whangamata, unfortunately.
Interesting. So it's a funny thing, when I used to spruik New Zealand wines in Europe and sort of show them a map, and obviously, it's a very rugged country made up of two main islands with lots of mountains. But, of course, with the Roaring Forties smashing into the West Coast, there, all the viticulture's on the other side generally, isn't it?
Absolutely. Probably similar for Tasmania in that way too. You know, the West Coast is pretty wild, lots of weather coming in there. You can get some really good rain coming through. So it's that, more settled, sort of sheltered middle through to the easterly places, which really lend themselves to some quality fruit.
Was it living in New Zealand, though, that sort of piqued your interest in wine? What's the Luke Whittle story? How did you get into it?
It certainly was living in New Zealand with probably a good amount of dumb luck as well. So I was sort of finishing up school and just had no idea what I wanted to do, really. So I always gravitated towards the science side of things. And saying that, I was a pretty terrible student, and that I wasn't that great at applying myself when I was at school. So I thought, right, I'll take a year out here, do something a bit more hands-on, because I always like the hands-on aspect as well. So I went away and built for a year, and I was coming back to do science. And a friend of mine was doing food science, so I thought, well, great, there's as good a place as any to start. You know, it was a pretty broad sort of first couple of years, but still wasn't really where I wanted to wind up. So I started doing that, and that was up at Auckland University, and that was about the time their wine science department was, they'd been doing some great things for a number of years before that, but they had a lot of really good research projects coming through there, and a lot more was starting to happen. And I was just sort of getting towards the end of my BSc in food science and looking around where I wanted to go post-grad, and it seemed like a bit of a crazy idea at the time. I didn't really have any family connections to wine or anything like that, outside that I've always really enjoyed drinking wine as a product. And I was sort of at that time then when I was really starting to scratch the surface a little bit more about just wanting to learn more about wine, because I'd always just purely been a go grab a nice bottle of Pinot. I really enjoy that. And then I was sort of starting to get a little bit deeper down that rabbit hole of, okay, you know, this Pinot from this place or whatever the case may be, and just wanting to know more and more about it.
Yep.
So, it certainly grabbed my attention. And, I thought, well, you know, it sort of ticked all those boxes. There's that real science element to it. But as well, it was a very hands-on sort of application to winemaking, which is something that was really important to me, as well as, you know, a good amount of there being that that really artisan side to it as well. It wasn't, you know, it's not just pure science or anything else. You've really got to have the two come together to make great wine. So I thought this would be a great option, and started doing the course. And while I was doing that, I was working out at a winery in West Auckland, and that was where sort of the hook really got set in. Getting my hands stuck into some fruit out there. I was working at Cooper's Creek and that was the 2007 vintage while I was doing my wine science degree as well, and cool. Just loved it. So that was me, never looked back.
You say there's an artisan and a science part of it, which I think is great. I think Nick Peterkin, who obviously comes from pretty famous winemaking stock over in Margaret River, has a winery called Las Vino, L-A-S, Luck Art Science. I reckon that's a pretty good way of describing making wine.
Perfect.
Yeah, I've always loved that too. As a former professional classical musician, I think there's a lot of luck involved in being in the music industry. Of course, there's a lot of science involved in, you know, the way things work in terms of music, but the art of it, the art of making wine, or at least, you know, allowing those little grapes onto the next great thing in life. So you're doing your course now. You're finished. You're doing your postgrad. You're working in West Auckland, and making a bit of wine. So what was the next step? You know, what was the first sort of gig that you had in winemaking?
First major gig was I finished up my wine science postgrad year there and had loved everything about it. I was torn between sticking around doing a master's or going out and sort of getting a job. And by that stage, I'd sort of been at school for 4 years and I was like, right, you know, it's probably enough of the books for a while. And just wanted to, you know, and I'd just done that harvest and loved everything about it. So I really just wanted to, you know, get more hands on with it at that stage. And moved down to the Waikato, which is really not a big wine growing region at all. But I was working at a vineyard there, Mystery Creek, which had a very small vineyard presence, which would take fruit from all over the country. So we had a lot of really great blocks coming up from Hawke's Bay, Gisborne. And when I went there, it was very small. So I went straight in as an assistant winemaker role, and we were doing, I think, 50 tons that year. And then the next year, because we were working with someone who had a huge vineyard that was just coming along down in Marlborough. So then we started bringing a lot of the Marlborough stuff up as well. And I think by 2 years down the track, there was another 1 million litres added onto that sort of 50 tons we were doing. So it was a huge period of growth and a really interesting time to be there. But really, really not a big wine growing region. There's only a handful of vineyards there who are, you know, really passionate about it and doing some great stuff. But there's, it's not one of the big regions you'll see on the map when you think about New Zealand viticulture, that's for sure.
I think of Waikato and I think of rugby. Is what I think.
Absolutely.
To be honest.
Absolutely.
I do notice, of course, this is radio, so the listeners won't be able to see this, but I see a bunch of wine, you know, just describe where you are, Luke. I also see a cricket bat up the top there. You're a bit of a cricket player or a cricket fan or?
Yeah, well, I'm actually sitting in my office at the moment. I did a mad dash away from work on Thursday because we had the Tasmanian Wine Show dinner and I'd had a heap of stuff in here. So I sprinted out the door, rate of knots, and forgot my computer and all that sort of stuff. So I just got back up from the top here last night, so my computer and everything is down here, so I thought I'll duck down here to have a chat to you guys. But we're looking at the back wall of my office there. Quite a few of the old Piper's Brook bottles kicking around there from times gone by, and there is a cricket bat, which was from a match we sponsored. I believe it was one of Ricky Ponting's final
matches.
Yeah,
it's Kookaburra. It looks like it could be a Ricky Ponting. Well, obviously, Ricky Ponting's got his own wines now. So
absolutely.
And
absolutely.
Ben Riggs makes those, I think, and they're actually pretty good. We had this incredible gift pack at Christmas with a Shiraz and a Cabernet, but it also had all this truffle salt and truffle mustard and all these great Tasmanian things, which is cool. All right, so you're making wine in Waikato, Luke, and then you came over to Victoria for a little bit too, didn't you?
Certainly did, yeah. The draw to come over to Australia for a while, and, you know, obviously when you're in New Zealand and looking across the, you know, across the ditch over here, there's obviously such a, you know, diverse and fantastic wine industry and really great opportunities to gain some more experience. So coming to Australia for me was only intending to be for a few years to, you know, come over and learn some new things and experience wine over here. But of course, plans often change. So yeah, I was working up at Balgownie Estate in central Victoria, which was fantastic, and working with a great team up there. And we were doing the Central Victorian wines, but also had vineyard down in the Yarra Valley. So we're doing some Pinot and Chardonnay out of the Yarra Valley as well. So great place to be. But yeah, a couple of years down the track. And for me, the plan was always to get back to the cool climate stuff. I mean, that was what sort of, you know, really got me on the hook in the first place. And coming from New Zealand, was always really passionate about that. You know, whilst we're doing some fantastic cool climate stuff out of the Yarra Valley there, I wanted to get back to New Zealand and get stuck into all the, you know, the Pinot and the cool aromatics and sparklings and everything that just I was really passionate about from the get-go. So that was sort of the next step. Was I had a window there for a couple of years and I hadn't done the, the travelling sort of vintage winemaking thing before that because I'd always been in sort of permanent roles. So I figured before I go back to New Zealand and settle in for good and it, you know, gets a lot more difficult to travel around, I'll take a couple of years and sort of duck back and forth to the Northern Hemisphere and do a few vintages. Left Balgownie in 2014 and I went up to Canada, did a vintage up in Canada, which was fantastic.
Cool. Up in the Okanagan region, something like that? Or?
Yeah, it was BC, but we're actually a bit further inland than that. So I was at a place called Bailey Gromer, which is in the Creston Valley. So we're about another 4 hours inland from Okanagan. So if you're familiar with Canada, we're right down on the border too. We're about 10 minutes off the border from the States. And it was just above where that panhandle of Idaho touches the border with Canada.
Wow.
Yeah, really interesting place. It was one of a very emerging sort of a place where there was only a handful of wineries there. And it was one of those places that everyone had, you know, previous to that said, you're mad, don't go there. You know, no way you'd be able to grow fruit there. Too cold, all the rest of it. But look, there's some really fantastic wines coming out of the place. And Yeah, much smaller producer. We did about 90 tons, I think, the year I was there, which was the biggest vintage they'd ever had. But yeah, it's really cool to see some of that Canadian wine industry, and still really had that pioneering feel over there as well. That you know, they're still really in those early days of building the industry and figuring out, you know, what goes well where and
can we do it?
All these sites. Absolutely.
Yeah, fascinating. Absolutely. So we've got Luke Whittle. You're listening to The Wine Show Australia on a Sunday morning, and he's the winemaker there, chief winemaker at Piper's Brook Creglinger. Just before we go on to the next sort of phase of your career, I've had a text come through. Someone hasn't put their name on it, so which is a good one. It's like, did they let Luke use the spa at Balgowney? Was that one of the perks of the industry? Did they drive down to the Yarra, or were you just stuck up there in Bendigo, mate?
Look, all the winemaking was up in Bendigo, but I was spoilt to a couple of weekends down at the spa in Yarra Valley there. So there were a couple of perks that came out of it for sure.
That's why your skin looks so beautiful, mate. It's not all the antioxidants from the grapes. But how did you end up down in Tasmania then?
Yeah, well, I'd done, so I was in Canada, came back to Australia, and I went back up for a vintage, and Tasmania had always fascinated me. Obviously, being in Australia, I'd had a chance to try some of the wines, because we really don't hear much about, well, at that time, didn't hear much about Tasmania when you're back in New Zealand. You know, there's the, you'd hear everything about, you know, the Hunter, Barossa, Yarra, all of these sort of places, WA, you know, and we'd see a lot of the wines come over, but Tasmania, we really didn't hear a huge amount about it, and it was very underrepresented in what we'd sort of see on the shelf over there. But having you know, with the passion of the cool climate stuff and being up in Victoria there, got to try more and more Tasmanian wines. And it was definitely somewhere I wanted to go for a vintage before heading back to New Zealand. So I was lucky to get a vintage in 2015 to come down to Piper's Brook. So came down here, worked for the vintage in 2015, just as a vintage cellar hand. Went away after that, did a vintage up in Germany. And then I came back, and I was up in South Australia doing a vintage, and the winemaker from Piper's Brook had left. It was about January, February, and there's a couple of the guys I worked with here in 2015 who there's assistant winemaker and the lab manager, and I was sort of chatting to those guys, and they had a new CEO come on at that time, and they were sort of, you know, started feeling me out like, hey, do you reckon you might be able to pop down for a vintage winemaking contract? You know, we're sort of vintage is rolling around quick and there's still a lot of stuff to organize and everything, and having been there the year before, obviously I was familiar with the site. So I managed to work it out with the vintage I was doing at that stage to shorten my contract by a month, because we were just coming off the back of the peak of the vintage in South Australia. So they were really good, and, you know, being good about me disappearing a bit early. And so I remember I finished up in South Australia. It would have been the 12th of March, and came down here and started work on the 14th of March, and we're already about a week into harvest, and it was full on, to say the least. It was a bit of a roller coaster of a vintage, and right into the deep end for myself. And at that stage, it was just a 3-month vintage winemaking contract, and that was all it was supposed to be, or that was all I was coming down for anyway. But the more I was here, and the more I sort of, you know, saw that potential in Tasmania and drank more Tasmanian wines and just experienced the region as well, because it's such a beautiful place down here.
Yeah, I can see why a Kiwi would love being in New Zealand, as we sort of mentioned before. I mean, there are many parallels I think we can draw, even in the wine industry as well. And Ewan and I were talking last night about what we're going to do in the first half an hour of the show, and one of the ideas was to talk about Tasmania, because it's coming, you know, it's coming. It's going to be huge soon.
I think so, yeah, and you really feel that. And coming down here, I felt that from day one. You could just, you know, the potential of the wines is just huge. And we've been in this period for a long time now. We've just been in so much undersupply as well, from like a fruit point of view. And you know, there's the demand is fierce, and you know, we probably, it's something that I've sort of been conscious of too, is we probably haven't experienced the international recognition we could have if we actually had enough volume coming out of the state to be able to supply more internationally. And I know a lot of people, us included, we really don't do much exporting, just because, you know, we've only got this much to work with. Mm. And the domestic market's sort of where we've always, you know, been more committed to being able to supply the domestic market, so it just doesn't leave a lot to be able to focus on a lot of export opportunities.
As long as you keep exporting it to the mainland, brother, that's all we care about.
the big island is certainly up on the list, Rousey. We're never going to sell you guys short. So,
describe for our listeners a little. Oh, sorry, mate, go.
I got down to Launceston beginning of last year and went, you know, up and down the Tamar on both sides of the river and things. And, you know, you discover when you're there, and there's got, like, you know, Launceston's a beautiful place to begin with anyway, and then you know, you go look at it, there's a few little spots you can go and try some wines, there's the amazing Pinot shop and things like that, and then you but then you realize like, oh wow, like I had no idea about probably a quarter of the labels. So there's, it's that classic wine region thing as well, like Tasmania's doing that thing which a lot of great wine regions do. There's a lot of really good stuff. It's so small that it actually never leaves the region, or it doesn't leave the state. So when Richo says, like, yeah, keep exporting to the mainland, like, it happens, but, like, there's what, you know, going on? Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Well, it's interesting, actually, yeah. Also, given that there's a few, there's three Dan Murphys down in Tasmania now. So there was Launceston, now there's one in Belrive is the newest, and the other one in Newtown. But they just couldn't find enough Tasmanian wine to fill the Dan Murphys. There wasn't even enough to keep it within the city. So, yeah, it is pretty amazing stuff. Now, just for our listeners, Luke, can you just tell us a little bit about, so Ewan mentioned Launceston, so we're talking a further north in Tasmania, and just take us in a little bit around the general region, and we'll dive into the wines as well after that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're entirely in the northeast of the state. So we've got six vineyards that we own, and pretty much, I want to say it'll be about 90 to 95% of our fruit that we work with is all estate-grown fruit off our own vineyards. So we've got a vineyard in the West Tamar. So more generally speaking, yeah, Launceston, we're in the north, sort of just slightly to the east of the north. And as you head up the Tamar River, which comes down from the Bass Strait into Launceston there, we've got one side of the valley goes up the West Tamar, which is where a lot of Tasmanian fruit comes from. I think it's still the biggest growing region in Tasmania. There is some fruit grown on the east side of the Tamar as well, but then you go further east from there. So we're still only about 45 minutes from Launceston heading northeast, and you get to the Piper's River and Piper's Brook regions. So four of our vineyards are in Piper's Brook, Piper's River region, all within sort of 15 minutes of the winery, which is based out there as well. But we do have our vineyard over in the West Tamar, which is quite a substantial site. And we've got a very small vineyard, which has only got 3.3 hectares of Pinot Noir in it, actually in South Launceston itself, just tucked away up on a hill there. So that's sort of where we operate from.
And what are the different brands that you sort of make there? Because I mentioned Piper's Brook, Craiglinger, like how does that all fit together?
Yeah, so we've got our Ninth Island brand, which is our more early drinking style of wine, very approachable style of wine, and wines which we're sort of looking to represent, you know, exceptional value and just good representation of some really nice early drinking styles out of Tasmania. And then we've got our estate brand, which is for the Piper's Brook Estate wines, which is much smaller makes than the Ninth Island, and that's really trying to really focus in on the best of what we can do from across all of our vineyards. We've got both sparkling and table wines in our Ninth Island range. Our Piper's Brook Estate range, we've got one sparkling there, our Piper's Brook Estate Sparkling, which we're about to release in LD 2017 Piper's Brook Sparkling as well. And then we've got our table wines, both Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and some of the aromatics. But then we've also got our Craiglinger range, which is our Icon Sparkling. So we do our vintage Craiglinger wines, and we've just recently also introduced a non-vintage Craiglinger Sparkling, both in the Brut and the Rosé.
One of my favourite wine stories, I was up there, we won a trip down to Launceston with Bogues, actually, and they gave us a bunch of golf games at Barnboogle Dunes and spending money and accommodation and all this sort of stuff. So we thought, well, we'll get out and taste some wine, and we're up there at Piper's Brook, and I just remember this couple in there. They're like, oh, we love the Craiglinger, darling. And the guy was like, no, mate, it's Craiglinger. No, it's Craiglinger. He's like, mate, it's Craiglinger. But speaking of Craiglinger, 2017's on the shelf at my dance. Now, we met at a dinner you know, over there in South Yarra, and you just won the Sparkling of the Year at James Halliday Awards with the 2017 Rosé. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a really fantastic result for the team there. Really proud to get the wine up there. But look, it was a wine that we were just immensely proud of as well. So, and I guess, you know, part of my personal journey here as well, because came on in 2016, you know, just on the eve of harvest, everything was pretty crazy. I was there in a vintage winemaking context. And then 2017 came around, and I was in a permanent role then. And it was one of the wines that us and the team, we could really, you know, say from the very outset, this is what we want to do with this wine, and have a really considered approach to how we're going to do everything from viticulture right through to the winemaking. And look, we're immensely proud of that wine, and this is the the thing with vintage sparklings as well is just that huge amount of patience it takes, because you're putting down this wine which you know is going to be a cracker, but then, you know, we're going to sit around and twiddle our thumbs for 4 years before we can even disgorge it and then liqueur it, and then have it sit around for another 6 months under cork before we look to release it. So to finally be able to take these wines out and, you know, share them with people is just fantastic. And then to get an accolade like that is pretty humbling. So yeah, excellent result for the team, and really proud to get that up there, and also have a, you know, way too big a night out in Melbourne to celebrate at the Worcester there.
Obligatory. Were you drinking 2017 Krieglinger Rosé out of a trophy? Was there something like that?
Unfortunately not. Definitely missed an opportunity there.
Well, next time. So I've got the fifth Beetle, Christopher, who's one of our loyal listeners. He's texted in again. He wants to know, is the vintage Brut made up of estate fruit, or is it all over from your vineyards all over?
All estate fruit. Yeah, it's actually something that wasn't by design. It's just where we wound up. All of our vintage Krieglingers are actually single vineyard wines. So, right. The idea was never to have that kind of narrow focus. Like I say, we've got those six vineyards that we operate over, and we draw some sparkling fruit in some way from four of those six vineyards. But we've got one really beautiful site, which is just up the road from the winery. It's about sort of 35 to 40 years old. I think the different blocks went in starting in the mid-80s through to the late 80s. And it just year in, year out would give us the most phenomenal sparkling parcels, but not only the quality, but the style in which we thought really just represented, what we would see in those regional characteristics coming through from the Pipers Brook and Pipers River, and what that's all about, what it means to us for sparkling. So we, started to, put these parcels together, and inevitably the best wines we can make, because our Krieglinger vintage wines they're our icon sparkling wine, where it really, for us, is just about we're not chasing volume. If the volume's not there, then the wine's not there. So it's just about those very best parcels that we think are, live up to that label. So, that's actually been a single vineyard wine for the entirety of the time I've been here, all from our Hills vineyard just up from Pipers Brook.
And is it something, did you have to learn a certain technique of tasting, or, I know that they would have had a program of having base wines. I know it's a vintage wine, but, you've got to pick these grapes earlier, don't you? And there's a lot of magic around the sort of blend and how it's going to, you say it's on leaves for 4 years and all this stuff. Take the listeners into the process of making sparkling, because it's bloody magic, isn't it, really?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And look, this is a massive learning curve for me coming down here as well, because I hadn't made sparkling at this level before, and stepped into this traditional method sparkling portfolio where we're doing these wines from these Krieglings at the very top end through to our Ninth Island sparklings, which are incredibly important wines for us, and we think represent fantastic value and really smart wines in themselves. So yeah, it was a big learning curve, but and most of our sparklings do come from this Pipers Brook, Pipers River region, because it is, even in the Tasmanian landscape where we're quite cool all over the state, we are very cool here, and we have that beautiful long, slow ripening season, which is really important for sparkling, because we don't want too much sugar accumulation, because that's going to result in a lot of alcohol, which is, for sparkling, you can just never achieve that balance at those higher alcohols. So we're looking at earlier harvest, lower alcohol wines, but still with this really cool region here. We're heavily influenced by the maritime climate, because we are very close to the Bass Strait. So we've got these nor'westerly patterns coming in off the Bass Strait right throughout that growing season, which really moderates those daytime temperatures. It means we get a little bit more precipitation. It means we get challenges in other areas, but it also means that really long, slow growing season, we get this really beautiful flavor accumulation, these really delicate sparkling flavors and aromatics, but still in an ultimately, really nice and balanced wine with that cool climate acidity. We're just perfectly situated to be growing really quality sparkling fruit here. So that's probably one of the fundamentals for sparkling, is just being able to get your fruit ripe, but in that really sort of early ripeness stage, we've got these really beautiful, delicate flavors coming on, but you've still got a lot of that retained natural acidity and still really low sugars and really low alcohol. So picking decisions for sparkling is probably your first and one of the biggest influences of quality you can do, getting that at just at the right stage where you've got those flavors coming in, but it's still really nice and balanced. As I said, all of our wines are traditional method sparklings, so first stage is really not too dissimilar from a lot of white wine making, in that we're trying to, albeit we're probably a lot more focused and sparkling on phenolic uptake and how we handle that fruit and how we press that fruit. So with our Krieglinger range, everything's hand-picked. we want to handle the fruit really cold, and also we want to do really gentle pressing and really small extractions. And when we're talking about extractions, we're talking about our press fractions, whereby we're pressing those whole bunches. They're going straight into one of our pneumatic bag presses, and we've got basically just the air inflates behind a canvas bag and presses that fruit gently up some screens on the other side of this cylindrical drum, which is probably not doing a very good job of painting the picture of that. But you are squeezing this fruit, and the more you squeeze the fruit, the skins start to break up. The more you've got that juice starting to come in contact with those skins, you're straight away picking up a lot of these tannins and phenolics, which are you know, in those skins, and even in the seeds as well. If you start to break up those seeds, you'll get a lot of quite bitter tannin come out of the seeds. And in a sparkling, we want a really beautiful, delicate, pristine juice. So what that means is we take much less juice when we press those grapes. So if we press a ton of fruit, the first 400, 450 litres, that's what we'll take to make these vintage Krieglinger wines. Yeah. Now, if we're talking about a table wine context, say let's Pinot Noir, where we press the whole lot and we don't actually take press fractions for Pinot Noir, we'll be taking about 720 litres per tonne.
Yeah.
So really trying to get that nice, delicate juice so we can have a really fine, delicate sparkling, you know, once we get through that fermentation phase. And yeah, then it's into primary fermentation, which we do for our vintage wines. We do it all in large neutral barrels. So we're using puncheons, which are 500 litres. And that's just trying to get some more of that interaction with that yeast and build some of that barrel ferment complexity into the wine from that early stage. So yeah, we don't want new oak because it can very quickly overpower a sparkling wine, especially our sparklings, which are in that very delicate sort of finessed end of the spectrum. So
yeah.
We've got very neutral barrels. They're more than 5 years old, so we're not going to get a lot of oak flavor come through, but we do get all those benefits of that barrel fermentation and that extra lees contact and all that sort of creaminess you can build on the mid palate, some of those more sort of spicy barrel fermentation complexing factors, which can look fantastic. So, yeah, it's fermentation in oak for our vintage Krieglinger wines. A lot of our Knight Dyla wines will ferment in tank. And then once that primary fermentation is done, we obviously have a huge job trying to put these blends together. So especially for the Krieglinger, you know, where we're really trying to find those really small but just absolute top parcels that we can out of our vineyard resource. Now, we've honed in a lot of that over the last 6 years, which is, you know, one of the biggest things about stepping into any vineyard is starting to learn those different sites and learn where you're going to find those really best parcels from.
Yeah, for you create a little bit of focus in that, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Because, I mean, some of these, you know, it's not like even just saying, all right, this block's fantastic, we're going to take that for this wine. It can be, over time, we might say, all right, we'll pick this, you know, top first, whatever it is, 10 rows of this block, because we know that ripens at a slightly different time and it gives us these slightly different characteristics. And really honing in on those really special parcels is sort of one of the biggest, you know, factors as far as trying to find these beautiful wines to be able to put those parcels together and create our vintage Krieglinger wines. So then we're primary fermentation off the back of that. Obviously, we're terraging for the bottle fermentation, and then we, they go down to our terrage room and age on those lees and those bottles, which is a massive qualitative part of traditional method wine.
Absolutely.
Those lees are probably one of the biggest friends we've got to work with in winemaking, but also in sparkling winemaking, because and in the context of traditional method sparkling, when they're sitting on those lees, because the secondary fermentation happens in bottle, we've got that active yeast culture, they'll ferment through the residual sugar we've put in there.
Yeah.
Then they run out of nutrients, they'll die, they'll fall out to the bottom of the bottle, and then they, about 6 months later, will start going through this process of autolysis, where they start breaking down and releasing compounds into the wine, and that's where we start to build that beautiful, creamy sort of mid-palate we get from a long time sitting on lees, as well as some of these really nice, what we call autolysis characters. So there's nice biscuity, bready notes that come through. And massively important part for the quality of it. Also in creating the really fine bead. So it's something where those yeast are releasing some compounds into the wine, which help generate those really fine, small, delicate bubbles that we associate with traditional method sparkling. And that in turn really impacts on that creaminess and that palate sensation of having that really fine mousse in the wine. So really important stage of it, of the winemaking process for us. Mm-hmm. When we feel the wine has been on terrage for long enough, we'll look to then go to the next step of disgorging, because we've got these dead yeast cells sitting in the bottom of the bottle.
Got to get them out somehow, don't you?
Got to get them out, yeah, absolutely. So that's where we get into our riddling and disgorging to remove those dead cells from the bottom of the bottle, and then We had a liqueur at that step as well, and then under cork, and 6 months later, because it's got to sit under cork for a while as well, which is another important time.
Settling in, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a great process, but it is, if you think about, like, it's a $60, $70 wine, whatever, that feels like it should be more expensive, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The time frames on it are just crazy, yeah. So, it's something that it's hard to justify to the accountants, but there's just no other way to get that end result and to get that same wine and that beautiful quality than, you know, going through this really long traditional method process and all that time aging on lees. And, I mean, I probably just, spurted out a few things over a couple of minutes. But if you hone into any one of those processes, you could talk about that for 2 hours because it's just so detailed every step along the way. And that's one of the fantastic things about sparkling is, you know, there is this really intricate, detailed side to it as well.
Yeah. Well, it's handy that you can speak about it for so long because our listeners will notice it's 11:05. And but the next show, which is the Scouting Guys, they haven't turned up, so we're just gonna ask you a few more questions and play some tunes and see what happens, I suppose, which is part of the fun of doing live radio on a Sunday morning on a community radio station. So Luke, what do you take your cues from? Are there any other sort of sparkling wines from Tasmania that you're into? Have you learnt anything from the other guys? And do you drink champagne? And what, if so, what do you like to drink?
I'm going to say yes to all of those questions, Richo. So, it was obviously there's some fantastic sparkling houses down here in the state. And we're sort of in that process now, I think, where everyone's, you know, had a lot of learnings and had a lot of time and really started to build some quite unique house styles and have that really consistency of styles between the different sparkling houses down here. I think we're really sport in Tasmania at the moment to have some of these fantastic wines and, you know, and also not only different house styles, but wineries drawing from different regions around the state as well. It's something which we probably don't talk about a huge amount because we're one GI as Tasmania, but that encapsulates the whole state. Now, we've got a lot of sub-regionality down here as well, which does have quite a big impact on how those wines look. So we're probably, at one end of the spectrum where all of our wines are coming from a couple of different sub-regions within the Northeast. And then you've got other companies, Arras, for instance, who are drawing from some really fantastic vineyards from a wider area around the state. And that, once again, is going to, you know, heavily impact that style. So, yeah, I think that's one of the good things, which I think we can now celebrate about Tasmania, is not only the quality of wines, but some of the diversity that's coming through from that those different sub-regions, as well as the different house styles. And that's something which I was we're just down at exhibitor tasting Friday for the Tasmanian Wine Show and having a good look through all the wines there. And you look at them in a context like that, we've got a whole lot of them lined up along the bench. And it's just so fantastic to see that not only that, you know, variations in style and wines, but just the consistent level of quality which is starting to come out of the state now. So that's really great. And I was fortunate enough to head over to Champagne for nearly a week. Just going into, I think it was, it seems like a long time ago now, but it was only September last year. Obviously they've been doing what they've been doing for, you know, centuries now. They've got a bit of a head start on us. And there's, the technology over there as well. And you know, everything that they've sort of, is a big part of what they're doing now is really eye-opening. And as well as the sustainability side of it was something which really sort of caught my eye when I was over there as well, and how passionate they are about that, and the a lot of the houses going organic and really much more of a focus on sustainability. But it's not just them promoting it and talking about it. You can feel it when you're there that they're really passionate about this because of, you know, it's such a important part about the future of the region. So
it's something, because you were over there last year, September, October as well, right? Given that I've never actually I've never travelled through, but it feels like it's not a really dynamic place because we're over in Australia and we just don't know, but it is actually really dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And I think across all things, it's a fabulous wine region. I think, you know, like you refer to that, you know, that there's a sort of an energy there, and there's a sort of that, yeah, it's France. They're incredibly proud of their, they're called the patronois, like the, you know, it's what comes down through the culture and the thing, particularly in farming and, you know, champagne basically being the number one agricultural product in the world.
Yeah.
Right. You can find all things. You can find the most absolute pomp and pretense as well. but you've also got just like in every little village and stuff. I mean, the actual tapestry of Champagne is much more about small holdings, small growers, people with a couple of hectares, and incredibly proud if it, you know, they've got a parcel of Premier Cru, let alone Grand Cru, and things like that. And the amount of bottlings that you, well, the amount of labels and stuff that, you know, there's one level that we showed to the world, and you had that question before about Grand Marc or growers and stuff, but
yeah,
it's no doubt that, you know, Grand Marcs have helped bring the style to the world and build the build a lot of the pizzazz around it.
Yeah.
But actually going there is just such a treat, and the gastronomy is amazing too. And like, it's kid in the candy store stuff, really, when you get like, if you just take a couple of days to see. I walked around, you know, a lot of people drive around the villages. I was walking through, they all thought I was mad, but you know, but literally people like there'd be a family in a vineyard to go, oh, go up the road and see my mum and taste some of the wines. Like,
yeah.
That's
amazing. And Luke, did you have a sort of invite to go somewhere and learn anything, or were you just sort of touring around? What was the vibe for you?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Yeah, called into a couple of bigger houses. We were sort of, made an appointment to drop in there, and that was fantastic to see, what they were doing. So, called into Mob when I was over there, and called into Charles Heidsieck, and had some fantastic tastings, but also got around a few of the smaller producers as well. Pretty fortunate to have a friend who was over at the time who was going around and calling into some growers that they were familiar with, sort of down the Valley of Manway down there. So it was really cool to see that, you know, much smaller, once again, that, you know, sort of smaller grower end of the spectrum too, and just see some of the exciting stuff that they were getting up to, because it was just such a different feel from, you know, some of the bigger houses where everything was just so seamless. Then you go to some of these guys, and just, it was really interesting to see both sides of it.
Yeah, I didn't get down to the Marne, but very lucky to spend I was up in Rams and went to Epinay for a meeting, and that was also kind of fascinating as well, like a very new house that really is, you know, everything pretty much small production, but like almost setting up like an urban house in Epinay. Right, like, yeah, you know, like the sort of urban cellador vibes, like the sort of things that we see a little bit now in the Yarra Valley with mates down here at Peyton and Jones and that sort of vibe, you know. And I was like, this is great for Champagne to see this. But the other thing I just couldn't get over was France is always going to have great food, but the passion that was around, serving the wines, but also showing people, you know, the boozy rouges and all that kind of stuff, like the Coteau de Champenois. They're super rare. They're hard to get your hands on. But I think climate is making a bit of a difference there now, with a little bit of warmer. Those Coteau Champenois reds are getting a lot more approachable. I don't know if you got to try any of the still wines.
Yeah, certainly. And that was one of the big learning curves for me too, because I think, you know, we just don't see those represented in the market over here. Well, I certainly don't come across them a lot, you know, so to be able to have a chance to try some of those Coteaus over there. And it was really interesting. And I think it's a valid point too. It seems to be they are becoming more prominent over there with the, things getting a little bit warmer and it becoming more viable with some of these, table styles of wine there. So yeah, really, really cool to see that. And more diverse styles coming out of some of those smaller growers as well, where it's, you know, the playbook's not as relevant as it is for a lot of larger houses, and they'll just do some really unique and interesting things.
This is a bit kooky as well, but I know for sure that there's actually going to be a champagne sake coming out. I couldn't believe it. There's actually rice grown in the region, and there's actually going to be a sake made from the area of Champagne. It won't be a blend or anything. It's actually going to be sake made with champagne grown rice.
Unreal. I wouldn't have picked that one, but yeah, I'd like to give it a whirl.
For you, when you're looking at, you're putting together your blends with the Craiglinger, do you find that you sort of waited a little bit? You know, because one of the things about champagne houses, I think, is they draw a lot of their identity from having, like, oh, we're specialist in Chardonnay or something. And it's always dependent on what's in their vineyards. You know, if they've got more Premier Cru and Grand Cru Chardonnay, then, and that's the region they're in, they'll focus that way. And other ones are, you know, more Pinot Noir. Where do you feel like you sit with Craiglinger there? Do you feel like you have a clear identity one way or the other, or is it something you're still investigating?
Yeah, look, I think we've got quite a clear identity on that one, and I think we're getting very consistent with what we're doing there now. And, you know, look, inevitably with that process we've gone through, really identifying these best parcels, now year in, year out, we're seeing those same blocks more consistently be, you know, the identity of those wines as well. So we've got, once again, back to that single vineyard we've got where we source all of our Krieglinger fruit. We've got two blocks of Pinot in there, which are just, you know, absolutely fantastic and, you know, really regional, and seeing what we like to see out of that vineyard, where it's those beautiful, delicate, wild strawberries. It's also sort of an inherent spice character which comes through in Pinot Noir. You see it both in table wine as well as sparkling, but it just manifests differently between the two, where you get like some really beautiful, sort of a bit of a exotic, like Turkish delight, through to sometimes a little bit white peppery come through in that Pinot. But just that beautiful silky palette that Piper's River Pinot can have. So there are a couple of things we're really looking for there. And there's two blocks in particular where we know, you know, most years we're going to get some really fantastic parcels there, which will be a big part of those wines. Chardonnay as well, you know, like regionality out here and what we see from those sites, we just get this really beautiful citrus, you know, coming from that really kind of like delicate citrus blossom through to the sort of, you know, lemon pith, and just also it has such a wonderful long palate and fine backbone to it that, you know, it's just, sort of a really, really sort of beautiful style. And once again, there's two blocks we've got there, which we know we're going to find a lot of those parcels from year in, year out. And so between those couple of parcels and with the makeup of our wines, so we've got three vintage Krieglinger wines. Our vintage rosé is 100% Pinot Noir year in, year out. So our vintage Brut, we're normally 60% Pinot Noir, 40% Chardonnay. Sometimes it might edge back a bit more to sort of a 50-50 sort of a blend, but it's normally just ever so slightly Pinot Noir dominant. And then we've got our Brut de Blanc, which is 100% Chardonnay. So yeah, I think in that we're getting very consistent in which top sites are typically going into those wines. Our winemaking style is really solidified over the last few years. So I think we're very consistent in that way as well as the makeup. So I think we are starting to get more of that consistent style and consistency in what we're seeing come through there. Albeit, we're always going to get a bit of vintage variation in Tasmania. As part of the parcel down here, we're a little bit closer to the edge. And, you know, with those more sort of climactic extremes, I think we're definitely going to see a bit of that vintage variation, you know, not only in what we're getting character-wise through from the year, but some of the yield. But, you know, that's just an exciting part of Tasmania and something which we certainly embrace as part of our wines.
And obviously very much looking forward to Vintage 2023, Luke.
Very much so. It's beautiful sunshine coming down here at the moment, which was a little bit long coming this year. I think we had the wettest October on record, and it just did not stop raining throughout a lot of the early spring. But luckily, now as we're coming into the more pointier end of the season, it's about mid-December, it cleared up and we started getting some beautiful sunshine come through. And 2023 has been off to a fantastic start. It's been warm and lovely. And yeah, so hopefully we get a bit of this continue through to the harvest end of the season.
Ah, that's fantastic stuff, mate. And so it looks like our next show isn't happening, but I don't want to hold you too long on a Sunday morning. So lastly, Luke, we're listening to Luke Whittle, who's the chief winemaker down there at Piper's Brook in Krieglinger, Tasmania. When are you making your next trip up? After Vintage, you'll be spruiking the wines at some point up here on the mainland.
Yeah, yep, definitely be up after Vintage. May well pop up pre-Vintage to see how things play out. It's pretty hectic for us at the moment. It's normally a bit of a quiet time of the year, but yeah, it seems to be a lot going on at the moment. So I'll just sort of see how that goes. But as much as I love Tasmania to bits, I do love getting up to Melbourne as well, and, you know, up to the mainland and different parts up there. And so hopefully not too long, probably heading north again.
We'll have to make sure that Zachy pulls out a few magnums from his cellar again and takes us out to dinner, mate, because that was...
Absolutely. that was a fantastic night. Really good to go a repeat of that.
Yeah, more Pierre, Yves, Colin Murray, and magnums of Bill Carp. Thank you. Oh, and more Krieglinger. Thank you. That Rosé 2017 that won the award last year was Grouse. And sadly, we don't sell it at my dance, but we do have the regular sparkling, which is excellent. So thank you, Luke Whittle, so much for spending some time, extended time with us here on the Wine Show Australia on a Sunday morning. And good luck for Vintage, my friend.
Thank you very much, Richard. Thanks, Ewan. Pleasure talking to you both.
Yeah, Grouse. No worries, mate.